Okay, let's go ahead and get started. We're going to be looking into Gideon today, but I'd like to start with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day and for this church and local body. Father, we pray that the service today would be pleasing to you and that we might learn and grow from it. Father, I pray that I neither add or take away from your word and that it would be a benefit to those here. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so again, I mentioned we're going to be talking about Gideon. And Gideon's name, if you recall, means destroyer or mighty warrior. You could also translate it as feller or somebody who hacks. And I've got to get situated. We're not going to read it, but he is listed here in the Hebrews 11 Hall of Fame, if you will, for faith. And we're going to start in Judges chapter 6. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. So it was whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up, also Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. So we have the Midians and the Amalekites. Everybody remember where they came from? Actually, the Midians were descendants of Abraham and Keturah here. We see in Genesis 25. Abraham again took a wife, and her name was Keturah, and she bore him Zimran, Jokshan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. And the Amalekites were descendants from the line of Esau, Genesis chapter 36. Now Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These were the sons of Ada, Esau's wife. Now there's a long history, if you recall, with the Amalekites in Israel, and this goes back to Exodus chapter 17. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and called its name, "The Lord is my banner." For he said, "Because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." So that, of course, is continuing here. Then continuing back in Judges 6, verse 4. "Then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey, for they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it." So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. So they would plant their fields, and then as soon as the harvest came in, the Amalekites and Midianites would come in, take everything, and because of that, they were having to live up in the hills. We saw that for 7 years, this has been going on. And basically, Israel has... Through the cycle of judges, we know they've totally ignored God, and they've been doing what they like. And now everything that's gone wrong could go wrong here, and so they cry out to the Lord for help. Continuing, "And it came to pass when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel." And, of course, this is Gideon, and he's the only prophet listed in Book of Joshua or Judges, who said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them out before you and gave you their land. Also I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice." Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash, Abizrite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress. So again, so it's not to be seen harvesting, he's threshing the grain in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." Gideon said to him, "Oh my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." Then the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?" So he said to him, "O my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest of Manasseh, and I am the least of my father's house." So we have this response from Gideon that sounds just like Moses. He is very humble like Moses, but again, he's saying his family and his clan is too weak. And so the family again was from Joseph's oldest firstborn, and the name Manasseh basically means causing to forget. And the Lord said to him, "Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man." Then he said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that is you who talk with me. Do not depart from here, I pray, until I come to you, and bring out my offering and set it before you." And he said, "I will wait until you come back." So Gideon went in and prepared a young goat, unleavened bread from an ephah of flour. The meat he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot, and he brought them out to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. So we've seen so far that Gideon is familiar with the story of the Exodus from Egypt, and obviously he knows something about the sacrifices here. He felt the need to prepare one for the Lord. Continuing in verse 20, "The angel of God said to him, 'Take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth.' And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in the hand, and he touched the meat and the unleavened bread. And fire rose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. And the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. Now Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord. So Gideon said, 'Alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face.' Then the Lord said to him, 'Peace be with you. Do not fear. You shall not die.'" Verse 24, "So Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and called it 'The Lord is Peace.' To this day it is still in Ophrah of the Abizrites. Now it came to pass that same night that the Lord said to him, 'Take your father's young bull, the second bull of 7 years old, and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the wooden image that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of this rock in the proper arrangement, and take the second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the image which you shall cut down.'" So Gideon here is directed to basically remove all forms of idolatry from among the people. And where does he start? He starts in the correct place, basically with his own household, with his dad's altar to Baal. And basically up through verse 26 here, we found out the two reasons that the Midianites were put over Israel. One, they didn't obey, and of course the worship of pagan gods here. "So Gideon took 10 men from among his servants and did as the Lord had said to him. But because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night." Let's stop there. So think back to the previous slide. The Lord revealed himself to Gideon as "The Lord is Peace." Gideon named that altar place. which is Jehovah Shalom. So why do you think the Lord revealed himself as Lord of peace at that time? Why not the Lord of courage or the Lord of strength, since he evidently was afraid of his father's house? I don't think there's an absolute answer, but I pondered that for a while. And basically, I think obviously what Gideon himself needed was he needed that peace. He didn't need the strength. So that is what the Lord provided for him. Obviously, the Lord's peace is profound enough that it kind of overshadows everything else. Picking up verse 28, "And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, there was the altar of Baal torn down, and the wooden image that was beside it was cut down. And the second bull was being offered on the altar which had been built. So they said to one another, 'Who has done this thing?' And when they had inquired and asked, they said, 'Gideon the son of Joash has done this thing.' Then the men of the city said to Joash, 'Bring out your son that he may die, because he has torn down the altar of Baal and because he has cut down the wooden image that was beside it.' But Joash said to all who stood against him, 'Would you plead for Baal? Would you save him? Let the one who would plead for him be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him plead for himself, because his altar has been torn down.' Therefore, on that day, he called him Jerubbabel, saying, 'Let Baal plead against him, because he has torn down his altar.' Then all the Midianites and Amalekites, the people of the east, gathered together, and they crossed over and encamped in the valley of Jezreel." So we see that Jerubbabel here, the name that Joash renamed Gideon, is basically meant let Baal fight against him. And I thought it was interesting that obviously Joash is the one who had the altar, and he makes this 180 instantaneously in terms of supporting Joash, in supporting Gideon. And so I kind of wonder if he knew what he was supposed to be doing, but because of the surroundings, he was kind of going along with the worship. And as soon as Gideon took this step, that was enough for him to fall back in line, if you will. I don't really know, but that's a thought. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. Then he blew the trumpet, and the Abiezerites gathered behind him. So I want to stop here and notice that Gideon had to prove his worthiness to God basically before the Spirit of the Lord descended on him. He had to prove that he was worthy. Continuing now, verse 35, "And he sent messengers throughout all of Manasseh, who also gathered behind him. He also sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, Naphtali, and they came to meet them. So Gideon said to God, 'If you will save Israel by my hand as you have said, look, I shall put out a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only and it is dry on all the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand as you have said.' And it was so. When he arose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, 'Do not be angry with me, but let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry, only on the fleece, but on the ground let there be no dew.' And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on the ground." So question for you, was it wrong for Gideon to test God?
I don't think he was testing God as much as he was expressing his own doubt.
Okay.
His own faith. And that was the only way that he felt like he could be reassured by God that God really meant what he said.
Very good.
Hey, I can relate that way.
We have, We have Matthew 4:7. It says, Jesus said to him, "It is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God." And this is, of course, Satan tempting. And that looks back to Deuteronomy 6:16. You shall not tempt the Lord your God as you tempted him in Massah. And that refers back to Exodus 17:7. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel and because they tempted the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" We also have 1 John 4:1. "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." So we have, did that do anything? We have tempting versus testing, and this is really what it comes down to. Matthew 4:7, we have, again, Satan tempting Christ. And then 1 John, we have, written as test, do not test, but test the spirits. So if you spend some time thinking about this, really it comes down to tempting versus testing is really my will versus God's will. And we as Christians need to recognize that difference. We have every right to test the spirits to make sure it's God who's speaking to us, as we just read the passage. So obviously Gideon wasn't tempting the Lord, but he was testing. And there's 1 John again. So continuing Judges chapter 7 now. "Then Jerubbabel," that is Gideon, "and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Herod, so that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, My own hand has saved me. Now therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead.' And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Then it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you. And of whomever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go.' So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, 'Everyone who laps from the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink, and the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men, but all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water.' Then the Lord said to Gideon, 'By the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place.'" So we've seen that we've reduced the number of men from 32,000 down to 300. Less than 1% remains. And why? One reason, obviously, is Israelites would think that they had the victory, not the Lord. But I believe there's another reason, or there is another reason. Deuteronomy chapter 20 actually lists principles that Israel is to follow for governing warfare. And I'll go ahead and read part of chapter 20 here. "When you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. So it shall be when you are on the verge of battle, the priest shall approach and speak to the people. And he shall say to them, 'Hear, O Israel, today you are on the verge of battle with your enemies. Do not let your heart be faint, do not be afraid, and do not tremble or be terrified. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight you against your enemies.' to save you. Then the officer shall speak to the people, saying, what man is there who built a new house that has not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. Also, what man is there that who has planted a vineyard and has not eaten of it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man eat of it. And what man is there who is betrothed to a woman and has not married her? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man marry her. The officer shall speak further to the people and say, what man is there who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest the heart of his brethren faint like his heart. And so it shall be when the officers have finished speaking to the people that they shall make captains of the armies and to lead the people. Now there's a whole other section about equal amount that goes on further, what they are to do, and particularly in sieges and stuff. So but we don't have time to read that. So one reason I wanted to look here at Deuteronomy 20 is I think from this it's evident that really, and if you think back from the 3,200 to 300, God is, one, not interested in people followers. He wants those who serve him to be fully committed to him. And obviously, thinking back 3,200 to 300, God's power doesn't come from the number of people. So it really doesn't matter there at all. I'm not going to read this either, but Matthew chapter 22, we have, for many are called, but few are chosen. What I want to kind of get out from Deuteronomy and Matthew 22 here is that God reduced the number of soldiers from 32,000 down to 300. And he did that to prove that each person was suitable, basically, to serve him. And we'll continue now in Judges chapter 7. So the people took provisions and their trumpets in their hands, and he sent away all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men. Now the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. It happened on that same night that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah, your servant. And the name Purah here, I looked up, basically means branch, but Purah is probably his like armor bearer. And you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with Purah his servant to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. Now the Midianites and Amalekites, all the people of the east, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number as the sand by the seashore in multitude. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. It came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed. Then his companion answered and said, this is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp. So when I was studying this, one of the things I had really never paid attention to and is why was it a loaf of barley bread? I don't know if there's a real answer, but I pondered a while, so I'll share it with you. As Clyde used to say, it's worth what you paid for it. So barley, if you recall, in biblical times was more of an animal food or a food for the lower socioeconomic class, where wheat was really the grown for human consumption. And so perhaps the barley bread could represent the impoverished state of Israel, or maybe it's the humbleness of Gideon. Another possible explanation I came up with was barley was the main grain offering that was done at Passover. So perhaps this is to make us look back to Passover in Egypt. And then, not surprising for me, I thought of the Jewish feasts. If you recall, there were three Jewish feasts that pertained to the harvest. The first one was unleavened bread or first fruits, and that was the barley, dealt with barley. There was the Feast of Weeks, or what we call Pentecost now, which was the wheat. And then the last feast was Feast of Tabernacles, or the ingathering, and that was associated with the harvest of fruit. So I thought the, recall that the first fruits was a feast in which they would harvest the very first barley, and they would dedicate that to the Lord. They were not allowed to use any of the current harvest, if you will, until this feast was over, and that dedication of that first barley was more or less a guarantee of what was to come with the rest of the harvest. And if you recall, that's, again, basically Christ was our guarantee of what was to come. So maybe, again, this what you pay for it. The barley bread is simply a little tie back to perhaps one of those three things. Since it is bread and it's not just the grain, it could, again, just be the impoverished state of Israel. And so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshipped. So thinking back, obviously the Lord knew that Gideon needed this verification that indeed he was going to be able to do what the Lord had been commanding him, that in fact they would be able to take the Midians. And we'll find out later just how many people were in the valley that he was looking onto when he had that, when he got that confirmation. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand." Then he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet into every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. And the trumpet here is probably actually not like a brass trumpet, but the shofar, you know, the ram's horn. And he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. Watch, and when I come to the edge of the camp, you shall do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, and I and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp and say, 'The sword of the Lord and of Gideon.'" So if you think back from his calling, he was timid like Moses, and he followed the Lord. And finally, with this last dream interpretation, Gideon is finally now fully signed up, if you will, to the Lord's plan, as we see here, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just as they had posted the watch. And they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers. They held their torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing, and they cried, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon." And every man stood in his place all around the camp, and the whole army ran and cried out and fled. When the 300 blew the trumpets, the Lord sent every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp, and the army fled to Beth Acacia toward Zerah, and as far as the border of Abel Meholah by Tabeth. And the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, and all of Manasseh, and pursued the Midianites. Then Gideon sent messengers throughout all the mountains of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and seize from them the watering places as far as Bethbara and the Jordan." Then all the men of Ephraim gathered together and seized the watering places as far as Bethbara and the Jordan. And they captured two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed at the winepress of Zeb. They pursued Midian and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan. Now the men of Ephraim said to him, "Why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites?" And they reprimanded him sharply. So he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? You know, obviously I did this and while you were sitting at home. Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Ebiezer? God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeb, and what I was able to do in comparison with you." Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. When Gideon came to the Jordan, he and the 300 men who were with him crossed over, exhausted but still in pursuit. Then he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, king of the Midian." And the leaders of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand, that we should give bread to your army?" So here, Gideon and the 300 men in the army behind them, I assume, the others are worn out and they need bread, and so he is asking for help here. But the men of Succoth here basically are demanding more proof that, in fact, they will be able to be victors. So they actually withhold their support. So Gideon said, "For this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." Then he went up from there to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way, and the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered. So he also spoke to the men of Penuel, saying, "When I come back in peace, I will tear down this tower." Now Zeba and Zalmunna were at Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000. All who were left of all the army of the people of the east, for 120,000 men who drew the sword, had fallen. So you have 135,000 people, thinking back, that were down in that valley. And you can understand why Gideon is a little apprehensive with 300 people to take that number of people. So I don't doubt him in the least. And the Lord, of course, knew that and provided him the assurance he needed through the dream. Then Gideon went up by the road of those who dwell in tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbeha, and he attacked the army while the camp felt secure. When Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them, and he took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. Then Gideon and the son of Joash returned from the battle and from the ascent of Heres. And he caught a young man of the men of Succoth and interrogated him, and he wrote down for him the leaders of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. Then he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Here are Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you ridiculed me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand, that you should give bread to your weary men?'" And he took the elders of the city and the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. So obviously they didn't have a good ending. Then he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. And he said to Zeba and Zalmunna, "What kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor?" So they answered, "As you are, so were they. Each one resembled the son of a king." So I think this is interesting. We have Gideon, prophet, and here they're describing him as having the countenance of a king. Then he said, "They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you." And he said to Jether, his firstborn, "Rise, kill them." But the youth would not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a youth. In Jether, his name basically means surplus or excellence. Just FYI. So Zeba and Zalmunna said, "Rise yourself and kill us, for as a man is, so is his strength." So Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments that were on their camel's necks. So throughout the whole battles here, and then with Gideon himself killing these two kings, he obviously kind of lived up to his name as destroyer, mighty warrior, hacker. And we see here, as we continued, that the taking of these ornaments is the beginning of the snare that's going to entangle Gideon. Chapter 8, verse 22, "Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, both you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian.' But Gideon said to them, 'I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you.'" I mean, this is great, right? "Then Gideon said to them, 'I would like to make a request of you, that each of you would give me the earrings from his plunder.' For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So they answered, 'We will gladly give them.' And they spread out a garment, and each man threw it into the earrings, threw into it the earrings from his plunder. Now the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments, pendants, purple robes, which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the chains that were around their camels' necks. Then Gideon made it into an ephod and set it up in the city, Ophrah, and all Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house." The ephod is what the high priest would wear, like a vest kind of like thing. And so we see here, he again turned down the offer to be king for he and his son, but he requested this gold. And he obviously didn't want the kingship, but he chose to live like one. "Thus Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon." So, again, the cycle of judges here. They were ignoring God, cried for his help. They were delivered, and now that the problem is gone, they are no longer going to look to the Lord anymore. But God has granted them 40 years of peace nonetheless. "Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, whose name he called Amalek. Now Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash's father in Ophrah of Abiezrites." And the son here, Amalek, meaning is, "My father is king." And, of course, we're not going to chapter 9, but in chapter 9, he does become a ruler for a brief time. Obviously not a king. So, what are some of the lessons we can learn from the life of Gideon? One, who does God consider a mighty person? I'm not going to read this, but obviously not what's highlighted there. Not those that the world thinks are mighty. We learned it's okay to test the spirits and determine if it is God who is speaking to us. Being scared shouldn't stop us from doing what God has called us to do. Obviously, Gideon did that with the tearing down of his father's altar and the other idols, as well as the entire battle. And you don't have to be a spiritual giant for God to use you to do great things. Obviously, he wasn't one when he was called. And then also we can take comfort in the fact that in spite of his failures in terms of all the gold and the snare that became to him, he's still listed in Hebrews chapter 11, the hall of faith or fame, however you want to refer to it. Are there any questions? All right, thank you.